In the parashas that we're reading now, we come across last week's and this week's, to be specific, we come across a fundamental issue which perhaps would seem to be in some way out of proportion, or perhaps the Torah attach more importance to the subject than we might have thought. Perplexing subject, and that's a question of Lashon Hara. Question of forbidden speech, particularly that halachic category of speech which is constituted by saying things that are negative about people which are true. We've had occasion before to share some of the halachic angle on this subject, and perhaps we'll have time to do that again. But let's see if we can try to descend into the depth, or look perhaps a little behind the scenes in this subject and see some of its complexity and some of its importance, bearing in mind that it runs through our literature all the way from our deeper sources indicate that the very first event of breakdown in the world was occasioned by speech that was true and false, namely the Nachash, the serpent, speaking to original man, saying things that were true but distorted in a subtle way. And there are many difficulties, many questions, but let's see if we can try to put our heads into this. The deeper literature in particular is full of paradoxical or perplexing references to this subject. Let's see if we can try to work out some of it. First of all, I presume that present company this evening is all highly accomplished Torah students, and you're all familiar with the basic material here. Those whose energies are not in their heads but in their feet are probably elsewhere this evening. You know that the problem in this week's parsha is the feet. You know that. The meraglim, right? It means feet. But since the present company is not in that category, let's see if we can talk at the level of the head. In last week's parsha, we read one of the primal or primary references to Lashon Hara. Miriam, the sister of Moshe, sister of Moses, spoke against her brother, and she became leprous, for want of a better word in English, tzaraas, which means an outbreak of some sign on the skin, on the body itself. Leprosy is not the right word at all, but whatever tzaraas means, it is a miraculous indication of having spoken words that are not appropriate. And the whole Jewish people had to wait for her for 7 days until she was purified, and then they continued. That, we learn, is perhaps the primary source, the classic, or perhaps the most classic source for the laws or for the issue of this prohibition of speaking that which is true but negative about someone else. And it's followed, that's what ends last week's parsha. What begins this week's parsha is the question of the spies, the meraglim, who spoke negatively about the land of Israel. They toured the land and they spied it out, and they brought back a negative report. Again, a question of Lashon Hara. They said that which was, in a way, technically true but distorted about the sticks and stones, etzim vavonim, sticks and stones, really, of the land. And our classic sources indicate that the two are linked. Why the guilt was so intense and why they were punished so severely is because they had just witnessed the spectacle of Miriam, who said what she shouldn't have said, and instead of learning the sensitization that they should have from that incident, they made the same mistake, perhaps amplified that mistake, and of course we still suffer from that today. It's because of their error, and because of the weeping that the Jews engaged in that night, which happened to be the 9th of Av, Tisha B'Av. We cry every night, every year on that night. The Jewish people spent the rest of 40 years in the desert because of that. We were, the whole idea of exile in its protracted sense began then and continues. The massive consequence from that use or misuse of speech. Now, there are many perplexing issues here. First of all, if you look in the laws of Lashon Hara, you look in the laws of forbidden speech, it would seem that what transpired then had nothing to do with Lashon Hara. Right? Again, you have to understand carefully. These two incidents are the source, the main source we have of the prohibition. In fact, the phrasing, even the phrasing of the prohibition of Lashon Hara is not to be like Miriam. It's brought that way. And yet, it's very problematic. Let's study it briefly for a moment and see why it seems completely out of sync with those two instances. Very briefly, without going into all the laws, but very briefly, the law of Lashon Hara, of forbidden speech, right? Evil speech. What you call loosely in English slander or libel. But totally different sense than we use it in the sense of English or secular law. Is constituted when you say something about someone else which is derogatory but true. And it has to be true. If it's not true, you're transgressing an entirely different thing. Apart from lies, sheker, which is a Torah prohibition in its own right, you are also giving a negative name to someone who does not deserve it. That's another whole Torah category of prohibition. But when you say something honest, accurate, measured, specific, fitting about someone, which is absolutely perfectly accurate and true, but it's negative about them, you say someone gets angry easily, and it's perfectly true, you transgress one of the most serious prohibitions in the Torah, right? Lashon Hara. And the sources say, the Talmud says, that it's worse in one way than immorality, idolatry, and murder. And of course, there are no exaggerations in the words of our sages. It means that this negative comment that you make about someone, which happens to be true, in some ways worse than all of those three. Enormously negative. In a particular Kabbalistic sense, all the problems in the world are due to this particular problem. But the law requires that the Torah law is that in order to transgress this, you have to say something that's accurate and true about someone, and yet it's negative. Now, if you examine carefully what happened with Miriam, Miriam spoke to her brother. Right? She spoke to her brother, she spoke to Aaron, about Moshe. And she said, why is he behaving in the fashion that he was? Miriam misunderstood his level. Miriam did not understand that Moses' prophecy was on a level completely different than any other prophets, which happens to be one of the fundamental articles of Jewish faith. The Rambam lists it as one of the 13 articles of faith, understanding that Moses is on a level higher than any other prophet. That's a separate article of faith. And this was taught at this time. She didn't know that yet. And because she misassessed his level and assumed that he was a normal prophet, in which case his conduct in separating from his wife, whatever it was that he was doing, would not have been appropriate. So she criticized that. Now, halachically, that's not Lashon Hara. Halachically, it's not Lashon Hara. For many reasons. First of all, when you criticize someone to their face, who can defend themselves and answer, that's not Lashon Hara. That's called Teichach. On the contrary, it's an obligation. If she felt, not knowing the details of his level, which no one knew yet, that he needed to be reproved or rebuked. So that's not an avera, transgression of Lashon Hara. On the contrary, that's a mitzvah. Again, when you reprove someone, you tell somebody, why are you doing such and such, it's wrong. And they can defend themselves and speak back. Our deep sources, our early sources learned that she said this to Aaron in the presence of Moshe. They even learned it from a verse there. Or a juxtaposition of two verses, that he was present. What's wrong with saying a criticism that you believe to be meaningful and needed? On the contrary, it's a mitzvah. I'm obliged to correct you if I feel in the right way, in a loving fashion, not to embarrass you. I have to do that. So what did she do wrong? On the contrary, the way the Rambam puts it, if you examine the words of the Rambam, he discusses it at the end of the laws of forbidden speech, of Lashon Hara, actually brings it in the laws of the Tzara'as. Listen to what he says. I'll read you the words. He's bainanu ma'iro l'miriam anaviyo. Consider what happened. Put deep thought into what happened to Miriam the prophetess. She had dibra ba'achia, who spoke against her brother. Now listen to how the Rambam puts it. He doesn't say who spoke negatively and denigrated him behind his back, right, and transgressed Lashon Hara. Listen to what he says. She'haisa gedele mimenu b'shanim. She was older than he. She was his older sister. And isn't it the role of an older sibling to correct? That's the Rambam's bringing these details because he means to say that technically there were many reasons why she did not transgress this sin. She was older than he was, v'gidaltu al birkeha, and she raised him on her knees, meaning that she had a parental role, as it were. V'sikna ba'atzma la'atzilo min hayam, she risked her life when he was in the basket. You remember that Miriam hid, not to protect him, when he was floating on the river in the basket. She risked her life for that. V'hilo dibra b'gnusoy, and she did not speak in his denigration. She did not speak against him. Ela ta'ata. All she did was make an error. She compared him to other prophets. That's all. The Rambam says explicitly she didn't speak against him in his dishonor. And he was not concerned. Moshe was, because Moses was the humblest person who ever lived. He had no objection at all to what she said. The Rambam says so. He had not the slightest twinge of any negative emotion at all when his sister criticized him in a way that she thought was valid. Despite all that, miyad nansha b'tzara, she was immediately struck with this leprous manifestation. That's the story the Rambam says. Kal v'chomer, and therefore he brings the law. How much more so, libnei adam harishoyim atipshim, how much more so for human beings who are wicked and foolish, shemarbim ledabek delos v'niflos, who talk a lot of, very hard to translate, gedolos v'niflos means, again, I've got a very specific and deep translation here, but the simple translation would be people who speak great and awesome or mighty or transcendent things. I mean, what's going on? The Rambam first of all telling you that she really didn't transgress the sin. And yet we learn the laws of Lashon Hara and the prohibition from here. How do you learn a prohibition from an example that's not an example of the type? Right? She had all these reasons why she should have, and it wasn't a sin, and she didn't transgress Lashon Hara. And what does it mean, Gedolos v'niflos? What does Rambam mean that these people, foolish people who speak great, Gedolos means great things and niflos means miraculous things. What's that got to do with Lashon Hara? What does that have to do with Lashon Hara? The Rambam should say, she spoke, the common or garden understanding would be, Miriam spoke against her brother negative comments. From that, if she did it with all the justification, how much more should we learn that we shouldn't say negative things about people? The Rambam says no. First of all, she didn't speak Lashon Hara. And how much more should we learn not to be like the fools who speak great and wonderful things? What is great and wonderful things? Exaggerated, excessive. What does that have to do with Lashon Hara? Do you begin to hear the difficulties here? And the Rambam finishes with a very beautiful, poignant, unforgettable few lines. One who wants to organize, aim, correct his pathways, one who wants to walk the spiritual path, to distance himself from the meeting places or the meetings of such empty and foolish people who speak these sorts of things, to speak to such people, that you should not be caught up in the net of these type of negative people and their foolishness. This is the way of the gatherings of scoffers, those who mock and those who are evil. Incidentally, what does mockery have to do with anything? Mockery is another problem in the Torah. What's Rambam bringing that in here? A leitz means a person who belittles and makes light of things. What does that have to do with speaking negative things about people that are true? And then he goes into a long discussion here of what the process is. First of all, they talk nonsense, he says. Then he brings a verse. Kol ksil b'roiv dvorim. The voice of a fool is heard in many words. He speaks a lot. Doesn't mean anything. Empty words. And then he comes to talk about belittle the sages. And then he comes to belittle the prophets. And eventually he'll come to talk negatively about Hashem himself. But the discussion of those who are wise, he says, Sichas Ksheir Yisrael, those who are kosher people, is Ela B'divrei Torah B'Chochmah. People like that speak only Torah and wisdom. And then that's what he says. So our problem here is to understand, what's the connection between Miriam, who spoke about her brother, with all these exempting factors, if you like, and our learning the prohibition of Lashon Hara? In addition to all these particular questions that we've raised. Furthermore, in this week's parsha, we learn the sin of the Meraglim. The spies who went into Israel, they toured the land, and after the number of days, the 40 days that were there, they came back, and they brought back a negative report. It's brought absolutely clearly in all our sources that there's no mitzvah, there's no avera, no transgression of Lashon Hara against a country. You speak badly about a country, Israel, any country. There's no law of Lashon Hara against a person, against a Jew as it happens. You speak about a country or about inanimate objects or about animals, it may not be good, it may be, but it's not Lashon Hara. So here we have two examples. We have Miriam doing that, which it's, in the words of the Rambam themselves appear to be that she didn't transgress this sin. And then who followed suit and should have learned from her but failed to learn were the spies in the next parasha. They denigrated a country. They said Israel isn't what it seems to be and it's dangerous and There's no prohibition of speaking Lashon Hara against the country. And when they said v'chazaku mimenu, that the people who inhabit the land, he, the nation, is stronger than us, our sages say extreme things about it, because you know in Hebrew you can read that in two ways. The word mimenu in Hebrew has a two-layered meaning. To say that he is stronger than us, meaning that nation is stronger than us, mimenu can be read in two ways in Hebrew. He is stronger than us, or he's stronger than him. Meaning that the nation that inhabits the land, right, we can never beat them in battle, and we are doomed here, because simply translated, they are stronger than we. But deeply translated, because they are stronger than he. Meaning Hashem himself. And here they verged on some of the worst types of mistakes that a person, or certainly a Jew, or any person could make. And from there it was downhill, and of course we're still suffering the consequences. What exactly is going on here? The sages say about this that the problem with these people, you know, Tisha B'Av, just understand how far this goes. Tisha B'Av, the night of the 9th of Av, when we sit on the floor and weep for that event. You know, Hashem said, you cried on that night, unnecessarily I now fix a night of crying for you throughout history on that night. And we sit and weep and we mourn, we read the book, we read the Megillah of Eicha, Lamentations. On that night, because we failed to live up to what we should have, we failed to go into the land of Israel, and since then it's been one long exile. Even today in the land, we're not out of that concept of exile. Of course, the Megillah of Eicha is written alphabetically. Eicha, the Megillah that laments the destruction of the temple, which was the direct consequence, right? Again on the 9th of Av, of this particular mistake of the Jewish people. Eicha is written alphabetically, except for the last chapter, which also has 22 verses, but not arranged alphabetically. And if you look in the verses there, you'll see, look up which ones are, which ones are not, but you'll notice that there's a peculiarity in the alphabet. Unlike the normal Hebrew alphabet, the pay comes before the ayin. Normally it's reversed. Unusually, although it's perfectly alphabetical, there in that Megillah, the pay is put before the ayin. You know, pay and ayin are two letters. But pay also means the mouth, and ayin means the eye. So the sages say, shehikdimu pay la'ayin. They put the mouth before the eye. These spies, the meraglim, they put the mouth before the eye. Hikdimu pei la'ayin. They put the pei, learnt from the Megillah, that the pei is written alphabetically out of place before the ayin. We learn from this that these people who spoke negatively, they put the mouth before the eye. What does that mean? A similar idea is written in some of the deeper sources, perhaps some of the sources we shouldn't even really be studying. But it is quoted, and therefore those of us who don't study those things at least know that they reputedly written there. And what it says is as follows. Again, very cryptic statement. And I'll repeat to you what's written and see if we can try to, as much as we're able, to disentangle it. In the creation of the world, description of the creation of the world. Again, we're talking on a cosmic level here. This issue in the Torah of speech and misuse of speech, and what's called Lashon Hara, with all its complexities and problems that we've raised, goes back to an absolutely fundamental issue. And the way it's targeted, or the way it's placed, one of the ways it's most deeply positioned, or located, if you like, is in the concept of the creation of the world itself. And there it says that you have a place called Eden, and you have a place called a garden. A place called a garden is a place called Eden. V'na'ar yetze me'eden, and a river flows out of Eden, l'hashkes ha'sagan, to water the garden. That's what it says. Now, you know, when we're talking back there in Genesis, we're talking very deep things. Not only, perhaps least of all there, on the level of the actual physical creation. Obviously, that's included, obviously. But the primary level of the creation, of course, is in the spiritual worlds. And therefore, in a very simple translation, it means that there's a place called Eden, whatever that means, and there's a river that flows out of it, and it waters the garden. But on a higher level, there's something being said here. There's a supernal, ineffable place that's called Eden. You know what Eden means? In English it means Eden. But Eden means pleasure. It means ecstasy. It's some sort of way of denoting a situation of ecstasy. The Ramchal says that the purpose of creation is to create a being who can experience the direct ecstasy of knowing Hashem, of having a relationship with Him, of God. That's what we call the next world. The ultimate level of the next world is the dimension of having a relationship of oneness with Him. That ecstasy is called Eden. We talk about Gan Eden, Garden of Eden. But strictly speaking, the way it's put here is there's a thing called Eden, and then there's a river, and the river flows out to water a garden, which is a place of work. La'avda l'shamah, it says, man, woman, placed in the garden in order to work it and to guard it. Place of work. And on the very simplest level, we're talking about the highest dimension of the next world, some process called a river that flows, and it comes into a place of a garden, which very generally we can call this world, place of work, where we work. And of course the object is for us to work here so that we can retrace our steps back to that place called Eden. Now, the way that our very deepest sources talk about this is they talk about this pleasure, this ecstasy of Eden, in a way that's called oneg. 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 Oneg means pleasure. And they say that the problem here is that when oneg turns to nega, there's a play on the letters here, that when the letters get rearranged, that's when the problems begin in the world. Yeah, a cryptic Kabbalistic statement. Oneg and nega, you know, oneg you spell with an ayin. Oneg, ayin, nun, gimel. That's called oneg, means pleasure, deepest sort of pleasure. And somehow when that word becomes rearranged, and instead of being spelled that way, you rearrange the ayin, the same ayin that we spoke about before, and you write the word nega, you get a word meaning affliction. Nega means not only an affliction, but the affliction of the particular type of affliction that in English they translate as leprosy, which is that very affliction that is the punishment or consequence of speaking negative. So hear what we're saying. We're saying that when the original, understand deeply, that the original oneg of the world, that means the dimension of ecstasy for which the world was created, plainly the next world, ultimate world, how is that transformed from that level of ecstasy into what we call nega, which means the manifestation of all contamination, all evil and contamination, is when that word gets rearranged. And when the word gets rearranged, the word itself changes from meaning oneg, which is pleasure, to nega, which means the leprous affliction of the body. Again, what is going on here? You see that what's the very simplest level that's being indicated here is that the mechanism of changing oneg to nega, the mechanism of changing that ecstasy of perfection into the affliction of contamination is Lashon Hara. Because nega means that affliction of the body that is occasioned by speaking Lashon Hara. Now, you see, again, this is the... Let's try and spend a few minutes together and see if we can try and fathom some of these mysteries. Obviously, more important than all of this is the practical side. What are the laws of Lashon Hara? Again, I assume that you're all expert at that. If not, there's wonderful books, certainly in great detail, excellent books, at least two or three in English, that are very practical and clear. Yes, you have to be expert in the application of these laws. If this goes back to the root of creation, and if our sources say that the reason we're still in exile is because we're not careful with our speech in this area, obviously this is a perfect place to start. But nevertheless, let's spend our discussion this evening trying to look a little bit deeper into the source. And perhaps again we'll have time to, if not now, another occasion to go over the laws again. What is this Eden? What is this river? What is the garden? What does speech mean? Let's try to explore that. You know, the same deeper sources that I referred to before make a parallel. They say that this place called Eden, and this river that flows out of Eden, and this place called a garden, those three correspond to three levels of the soul. What we call neshama, ruach, and nefesh. Neshama is the higher part of the soul, that which transcends, which the Kabbalists say is outside the head, hovers over the head, it can't fit in the brain, even though the brain is its organ, it's too powerful, too much light. It hovers around the head like an aura. Then there's a level called ruach, which comes into the body, it belongs properly in the heart, in the blood, circulates, moves. The word ruach means movement. And the third level is called the nefesh. Nefesh is where it makes contact with the body. It's represented in tangible terms as our connection with the body, the sensuous lusts, drives, laziness, earthiness, the heaviness of the body. When the body speaks, that which we have in common with the animal world, that's called nefesh. The ruach above that is where we live inwardly, our inner life, our thoughts, emotions, inspirations. And the neshama is higher than most of us. Most of us very lucky to have any contact with the neshama. Very brief and fleeting moments of inspiration perhaps come from that level. The levels above that, but they're not relevant to... Those three are enough for us for now. These three levels correspond to the three that we mentioned before. The neshama, that highest level, which is perhaps beyond most of our levels of consciousness, that corresponds to what's called Eden, that world that is out of touch. We cannot reach into that world. The Nahar, the river which flows, that corresponds to Ruach, which means the flowing. Ruach means wind, movement of air. The breath in the sense of its movement. Neshama, soul, is very similar to Neshima, which means breath. But Ruach means the movement of the breath. Can't have a still Ruach. It lives all in its movement. And Nefesh means where it reaches the body. The word Nefesh in Hebrew means comes to rest. Vayinafash means comes to rest. Right? Shabbos is vayinafash. It means that the production, the creation, comes to a halt, it rests. Nefesh means other things as well, but that's one of the levels of meaning. Now there's one particular application of this that we need to focus on this evening. Hopefully it will make things clear. These three levels, the highest one that we call neshama, which is transcendent, that corresponds to a thing we call machshava, which is thought. Thought, the world of thought, potential, world of concept. And the lowest one, called nefesh, corresponds to what we call maaseh, action. The world of action, physicality, physical action. What is the connection between these two? What corresponds to that world that we call ruach, that force called ruach? And the answer is speech. Speech is the mechanism of connection. This is the point to focus on because it hopefully will shed light on everything. Speech is the level of connection that brings the higher world of concept down into the world of application. You have to understand that speech is not just saying words with the mouth. Saying words with the mouth is only one version of speech. It's the most perfect illustration of this power in the human levels of function. But speech literally means, the general concept of speech, means taking an idea, taking a root concept, taking that which lives in potential, and bringing it down into practical expression. You have to understand the Hebrew word dabar, the Hebrew root dabar, does not mean speaking. The real root means level of conduct or control, right? Like, for example, it says dabar echad lador. It means a leader of a generation, person who can control and manipulates and handles. Or, for example, it says yadber amim tachtenu. Yadber means to subdue. Yet, to certain nations will be subservient to another. It means that there'll be control. That's what it means. In Aramaic, the word dabar means to take and move. Take and move. Dabarinu means he took and placed him. When Adam was transferred from outside the garden to inside the garden, the Aramaic translation says, Hashem, it says, Dabarinu, he took him and placed him. Or the Aramaic phrase says, Puk Chazi, go out and see, Ma Amad Dabar, go and see what the nation is doing. Dabar, what they're doing. Doesn't mean speaking. What are they doing? Action, translation of thought into action, that's called dibur. Why is speech with a mouth saying words the perfect representation in the body of this thing? Because speech is directly taking ideas and putting them into manifestation. Speech is the most refined version of this thing in the body. Instead of doing it by a gesture, or by an indication of the body, or perhaps by dance, it's also a very potent method of speech. You simply take the ideas, you give them enough tangible clothing, as it were, words. But essentially, this is why speech is formed in the throat. The throat, the organ of the neck, is the organ of connection between the higher world of thought, that is the head, and the lower world of action, that is the body. Why is the voice formed in the throat? The neck is the organ of connection. Why do you have a neck? Why do you have a neck? Get it working. You have a neck because your body manifests that place of connection, the higher and lower worlds. And it's in that organ of connection that the function of connection has its root. The voice is produced not just in the neck. The voice is produced in the front of the neck. Right? You know that the spiritual notion, again, in our deeper sources, is that the front of a thing is always the side of kedusha, of sanctity, of relationship, of recognition. The back is always the side of negativity, darkness, unrecognition, excretion is always the back. Right? Elohim Acherim, which means other gods, is sometimes transposed as Elohim Acherim Achoraim, the back of. The front is always Kedusha, the back is always the opposite. The front of the neck, in fact, in Kabbalistic sources, is called Moshe. This is called Moshe. The front of the neck, the throat, is called Moshe. Moses, what is it? Because he's the voice of the world. Shechina medaberes mitoch groino shel Moshe. Hashem's presence speaks through his throat. He is the throat of the world. Now, this is again, it's a much deeper subject than this, but just by way of introduction, Moshe is this part of the body. He's the communication, perfect communication, higher and lower worlds. And the back of the neck, which is the opposite of Moshe, in Hebrew is spelt Ha'oref. Ha'oref means the back of the neck. The back always is the negative side. And if you take that word and you read it backwards, Ha'oref, it spells Paroi, Pharaoh. Yeah, you know, the front of this organ is the side of connection. That's Moshe who brings the voice of the higher world into this world. And the back, the darkness, the negativity of that concept, is his arch enemy, Paroi, is Mi Hashem. Who is he? He's not in this world. The neck is the organ of connection, and speech is the faculty of connection between higher and lower worlds. Every time you speak, whether it's words which show it perfectly and is most articulate, or whether it's a sensitive and subtle gesture of the body, which is a meaningful gesture, the giving of a gift, or a nuance of expression in the body that reveals what was in the hidden world of thought, this is called speech. Speech is the translation of concept into action, or concept into revelation, hidden concept into applied revelation in the world. That's what speech means. That is the river. The river that takes the hidden world of Eden, that cannot be grasped, that is never seen by humans, Ayin lo yiras Elokim zolasecha, the eye that can never see that, that's called Eden. That's why it's spelt with an Ayin. You know what the word Ayin means? Do you know what the word Ayin means? The Hebrew word Ayin, the letter Ayin, means a ma'ayan, a wellspring. Again, you can't, any other language is, all you need is the language. All you need in Torah. All you need is the language. It says it all. The Hebrew letter Ayin. This letter that they misplaced, the spies. They misplaced the eye. They put the mouth first instead of the eye. You know what the eye is? Ayin means a wellspring. The Hebrew word Ayin, al ein hamayim, on the spring of water. Yeah, ma'ayan. The ma'ayan means that is where the hidden water underground is bursting forth so that you can see it. That's what the eye is. The eye is the tool of bringing out that which cannot be seen into vision. That's what the eye is. The ma'ayan, the wellspring of the body, of consciousness, that's the eye. That which cannot be seen at all is ayin, ayin with an aleph, and transposed into ayin is not. With an eye, ayin, that means the tool that makes visible that which is normally not visible. When an aleph becomes an ayin in Hebrew, you always bring a thing down from its ethereal and intangible into something more that is the power of the tangible, right? That's beyond our conception. And the world of practical expression that we're in touch with. What joins the two is called speech. That's ruach. That's the movement that brings the one down into the other. What is speech? Let's try and understand this. When you speak, what you're doing is, you are attempting the impossible job of bringing that which you know and you understand as it is into a world of packaged and finite pieces that we call words. That's an impossible exercise. That's an impossible exercise. Before you begin, it's impossible. The way you understand things, we have to work on this very hard, because the tragedy is that we don't even know that there's a world beyond grasp and expression. We do exactly what those spies did. They put the mouth first. The mouth first means exactly that. That consciousness begins with what you can say. And on the contrary, our world has completely reversed it. That if you say it, that's the way it must be. So once it's published and printed and said, then that's the way it must be. On the contrary, our eyes see the way it's expressed. But the whole concept of the spiritual world, the spiritual path, is to be able to see that with the eye that can't be expressed. And then you have to do the very subtle and mature and difficult and arduous work of finding the words to say that which words can't say. Again, let's try even. Yeah, yeah. The problem with our discussion, of course, is that there aren't words for it. There are no words for these things. Our chances of communicating here are the mystical sources say that Only if you understand these things already, then you understand them. If you don't, then they can't be explained. But the point is, you do understand. We do know. We do share these things. The way you know a thing is not because of the words. The way you know yourself is not because of your name. If you need to remind yourself of your name to deal with yourself, you're in big trouble psychologically. You don't know yourself by words or by description or by name. You know yourself as you are. You have a raw consciousness of who you are. And the truth is, you should know everything that way. I'm not talking about technicalities or arithmetical procedures or mechanical things. I'm talking about essence. Words are the enemy of essence. Words are finite packages. You can't... That which is known in consciousness, which extends beyond the finite, which is the province of inner consciousness, of das, of inner wisdom, or what the inner eye can see, by definition cannot be said in words. The Maharal says, give an example, the perfect example, the one we need for this evening, is that Moses himself, Moshe Rabbeinu, could not speak properly. Moshe had a speech problem. He had a speech defect. He couldn't speak properly. So the wicked and evil and anti-Semitic approach that this world has is that he had a problem. He was an imperfect individual. He probably had some, who knows what kind of problems, and he had a speech defect. The Maharal explains that Moses, Moshe Rabbeinu's perfection was his speech defect. Because he lived in a world where things can't be said. He lived in a world where things are grasped in all their cosmic connections. He lived in a world where things are grasped as they are. Things grasped as they are spiritually, by definition, are beyond the finite confines of a world of words. And therefore, a person living on that plane, he could never compress. He lived in a world where all is one, where everything is connected to everything else. When you live in a world like that, how can you say anything? Whatever you say is false. No matter how well you say it, because each piece you say is only a piece of the thing. If you've ever lived genuinely in depth, if you've ever known something that's really meaningful, you know that it's impossible to say. And you know you can't communicate that. And you know that the more desperate the need is to communicate that, because that's what the real need is to be. You know that there's no hope of saying it. And the only hope you have of communicating is with someone who knows it already. And then you don't need to say it. But if you have a need to communicate those sorts of things, and you have to start speaking about it, you have no hope. And the more words you have to say, the less chance you have of getting it across. And if to really explain, you might as well forget about it. But somebody who knows you and knows where these things are, you don't have to, just a quiet glance is enough. You know it says in Pirkei Avos, all my years I grew among the sages. Kol yomai gadalti ben hachachamim, all my years, all my days I grew among the sages. V'lo matzasi laguf tov mishtika, and I never found anything better than silence. What did he learn from his teachers? He learned silence. That's what he really learned. What they said was nothing compared to the silence in which they didn't say. Amazing, amazing. Normally the Talmud repeats a thing that somebody learned from someone else. It says, said so and so in the name, I'm Rav Yehuda, I'm a Rav. Rav Yehuda said in the name of Rav. Right? He said that he said. In this case, he said that they did not say. That's what it is. He quoted their not saying. That's what he said. What did he learn from the sages? What did he learn from them? What they did not say. Not what they didn't say. The fact they didn't say it. Because to say it would have been, Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses was living in a world where to say them would have ruined them, would have brought them down into the finite, would have put them into those little boxes and packages that are words. After the Torah was given, he spoke normally. Because after the Torah was given, that miracle of an infinite wisdom being packaged into a certain set of finite words, which is Torah, after that miracle, he, as the representative, as the giver, as the voice, the throat of Torah in the world, he was able to speak. These are the words that he spoke. But until that miracle had been performed, that finite words, a finite world, can hold an infinite depth, he was unable to speak. And that is the Torah tradition, is that the real meaning is beyond words. And on the contrary, to squeeze it down into words breaks it. The sages teach that if you say something that is spiritually deep, you lose it. If you grasp it and it lives at its genuine level of vibrance, its vibrant level of dynamic life, and you say it in words, you lose it. Rav Simcha Zissel said he once waited 25 years to share with his students something that excited him spiritually. 25 years he waited to tell them. Because he was worried that if he said it while it was still alive in his mind and not yet part of the fiber of his being, he would lose it himself. Why? Because when you know it yourself, you know it with all your consciousness. But as soon as you choose the words, you bring it down to just what these words say. And that is not the thing anymore. We're not talking about technicalities. Technicalities you only understand if you can say. We're talking about inner wisdom. A technical subject you must say. On the contrary, if you think you understand it and you can't explain it to somebody very simple, you don't understand it. a mechanical, technical, arithmetical, logical process. If you can't speak it out, you don't understand it. We're talking about those things that are beyond the technical and the logical, those things that extend beyond the bounds of any finite system or structure. Those things, if you can say them, it's definitely not the thing. Are these clumsy words? Are we getting somewhere? There's so many examples, it will take us along too long perhaps to go into all of them. The Maharal says, an example. Maharal says that, you know, the Gemara says that a child, you know, the Talmud says that prophecy does not live anymore. What is prophecy? Prophecy is the ability to connect to that world. Ultimate problem. Moshe Rabbeinu's prophecy is a world even beyond that, which no other prophet could even approach or conceive. That's what Miriam didn't know. But prophecy means seeing that world. Or seeing the bottom of that world, the back of that world, something of that world. There's no prophecy left, the Talmud says, except three places. Dogs, children, and insane people. But children have vestiges of prophecy. Children know things, but they can't say them. When a child learns to speak, then he doesn't know the thing anymore. No, the Maharal says an amazing thing. The Talmud says, the Gemara says in the Tractate of Nida, that when a child is in the mother's womb, he's taught the whole Torah. Child, an angel, teaches him the whole Torah. Malach, he knows the whole Torah, sees from one end of the world to the other, there's a light lit above his head. He knows all the wisdom of the world. And when he's born, as he's born, by Malach, an angel comes, a satral pimp, strikes him on the mouth, and he forgets all his wisdom. A child is born in the world from a situation of knowing the whole of the spiritual world. He's born as a child, an uneducated, simple baby who knows nothing. The problem here is, why does the angel strike him on the mouth? When you wish to make someone forget something, you strike them on the head. Amnesia, forgetting, is a result of a blow on the head. A blow on the mouth does not make you forget anything. What is being said here? Says the Maharal, the blow on the mouth is the gift of speech. When the child is born into a world in which he can express himself, he can't know anymore. Because as soon as you can put it into words, then it's what the words can say. It's not what the thing is anymore. Experiences that are too big for us. You know, many people who have relatives who lived through the European destruction 60 years ago will tell you that those people never spoke. Many people never spoke about it ever. Ever. Many people tell you, my mother, my grandmother, we tried many times to get her to speak about it. She would never say a single word about her experience. Never, ever. Not a word. Many people err in thinking that the reason that those people didn't speak about their experiences is because it was too painful. Too painful. Once you start speaking, you open the scars and the wounds. That's not the reason. That may be true as well, but that's not the reason. The reason that those people did not speak about those things, not because they didn't want to, but because they could not. When you're dealing with an experience that goes beyond human consciousness, that which cannot be grasped, the enormity of which is beyond any possibility of any sort of expression or explanation, then which words are you going to say? Where are you going to start? Whatever you're going to do is going to be a travesty of what the thing... The converse, of course, is that when someone is carrying a pain that is too big to bear, their therapy could sometimes be to get them to speak. Because if the person can pour it out, and sometimes when the words pour out, they pour out. Then what happens is, from being an unbearable burden because it was bigger than their consciousness, it becomes something that is a finite package of words. It eases the burden, it becomes defined. There are many examples. The pure Torah example, is, of course, the example of the fact that the Kabbalistic wisdom is called Sod. Sod, the secret level, the fourth level of the orchard, that is called Sod, secret. What does secret wisdom mean? So again, our uneducated and superficial ear, we think that secret means that no one told you. Sod is a secret. What's a secret? Something no one told you. When they tell you, it won't be a secret anymore. You know, we would never name a thing like that. Because then it means it's a secret for those who haven't heard, but it's not a secret for those who have heard. It just happens to be a secret because no one told you. Obviously, when we name a thing in Torah, we mean an essential name. The word sod means it's always a secret. No one could tell you. Even if they tell you, it won't be the thing. The secret wisdom is that which the master cannot tell the disciple because there aren't words for that. All he can do is give him enough guidance so that he falls in himself. And therefore, no matter how much you know, no matter how much the master teaches, it's always called sod. It always is, can never be said. And the purpose of being here, the purpose of the world, is to be a human being who's connected to that. That's what Deborah is supposed to be. That's what the river is supposed to do. The river is supposed to water the garden. The garden means where you work and operate. This is the garden. This is the place, after the Shomro, this is where you do positive mitzvahs and negative mitzvahs. This is the place where you live. You want to swim upstream. That's what you want to do. You want to get up back, use that river to get back to Eden where it came from. That ecstasy of the oneness of a relationship, ultimately, which will last forever. This place has to be informed by that. If you live here in detachment from that, you're not going to get back there. This garden in which you operate, it has to be a garden that is informed by, that is watered by, nurtured, nourished from that world. That's what the Eden is. The word oneg, which means ecstasy, you know the letter spell? Ayin Nun Gimel? Eden Nahar Gan. Again, you just need Hebrew, that's all you need. The word oneg, that ecstasy that we're talking about, which is the next world, the three letters, Ayin Nun Gimel, Ayin is Eden, that place, Nahar is the Nun, and Gan comes down into the... What happens when you get that wrong? Stay with me carefully. When you get that wrong, when instead of being oneg, you start with a river. You start with the, you don't start with the Eden. You start with this, the mouth. Then you get Nega. Then you get the world of the leprous transformation. When you start with your mouth instead of the higher level, the higher world, what does it mean they put their mouth in front of their eyes? I'm combining various sources here just trying to get the message across. What does it mean they put their mouth in front of their eyes? Hikdimu pe la'ayin. They put their mouth in front of their eyes. You know what the eye is supposed to be? The eye is the tool of reaching into that world. Do you know what ayin means? That, you know, in seeing and hearing are the only organs in which beauty can be appreciated. Of the five senses, smell, taste, and touch, you can feel pleasure but not beauty. The higher level of beauty, spiritual beauty, you know, that which is, that's, the nose is the highest of the other three, and it says that the somehow the soul benefits directly from smell. But harmony, the pleasure of harmony, of opposites blending, of achieving something more than the sum of the parts, that you see in visual beauty and in that which is heard. But only the eye can exult in the pleasure of the sight itself. Tova Orle 9. The light itself is good to the eyes. It means there's a tremendous pleasure. And good to see the sun, it says in the verse. What you hear, when you hear beauty, when you hear that which is symphonically beautiful, the beauty is not in the ear. The pleasure is not in the ear. The pleasure is in the understanding of what's going on in that music. The pleasure, again, you certainly can't put these things into words. But appreciation of music means knowing what's happening in the music. It's in what we call the tziruf, it's in the putting together of the parts that the beauty. But that's not vision. Vision, the beauty is in the eye itself. When you see a scene of beauty, there's no construction that's needed. You know, that's why in English you say seeing is believing. But in Hebrew the word ri'iyah is the same word as ra'ayah, which means a proof. Seeing and a proof, yeah, means it is directly experienced. That's why at Sinai it says they saw the sounds. Roina Sakonis, they saw the sounds. Because at that elevated moment it was not possible to hear. Only the highest sense was functional. The highest, the beginning of the senses. The only thing higher than the eyes is the forehead and the brain, which needs to be discussed also. That world of completely closed and hidden, the inner depth. The beginning of contact with the outside world is the eyes. Vaytera Isha, the woman saw. First of the senses. And the idea is to take the eye, which reaches into that world, can see that beauty, that can have that pleasure, that ecstasy that relates to that world, and to bring it down through the mechanism called speech, so that which is expressed is an expression of that which is deeper. But when the river comes first, when you start from there, when speech is where it begins, and there's no meaning behind the speech, or when you put the mouth in front of the eye, which is the world we live in, where the speech is... It doesn't have to make sense. It doesn't have to be connected to that which is true. On the contrary, in our world, that which is spoken forms the truth. Not just that it's disconnected from the truth. On the contrary, this is what purports now to be true. We live in a world of highly sophisticated falsehood. Most of it, fortunately, is not false. It's just nonsense. And you know, the smaller the lie, the more dangerous. You know that. The smaller the lie, the more wicked. Because the bigger the lie, the more apparent it is. The smaller the lie, the more it claims to be true. The harm of a lie is only in its claim to the truth. If a lie tells you it's a lie, it's not a lie, it's true. It's not a problem. The wickedness of a lie is because it claims to be true. And those that claim the greatest level of truth are the ones that are the least distorted. But there's enough distortion to make them false. What was Miriam's problem? Let's go back again. Let's backtrack and try to understand. What was Miriam's problem? Again, the beauty of this is almost beyond any expression, let alone the correct expression. What did Miriam do wrong? She spoke about her brother. All she did, says the Rambam, was make a mistake about his level, that's all. That's called putting the mouth in front of the eye. She did not perceive his level. We're talking about, at Miriam's level, we're talking about one of the most cosmically great figures who ever lived. Her mistake was nowhere near what we call Lashon Hara, when the Chafetz Chaim goes to all the transgressions of Lashon Hara. All the things you can transgress in an act of speaking that which is. She and Aaron did not transgress any of those things. As we said before, the Rambam gives ample reason why she didn't transgress. She brought him up on her knees. She was his older sister. She was attempting to correct him to the best of her understanding of where he was going wrong. But her error was that at her incredible level, there was a dimension of speech that came before a true perception. Because a true perception of Moshe is living in that world which is beyond speech. She should have grasped, that means, what was required here was to penetrate into that world and to ascend into that world, which is far beyond any possible expression. Had she been able to do that, then this speech wouldn't have taken place. She spoke about that which was perceived at a level lower than it is. And that's where speech becomes a problem. Long before it becomes a technical area of Lashon Hara. This is the root. Speaking about a country is not Lashon Hara. But it's putting the mouth before the eyes. Instead of seeing accurately, silently, the way things are, and then the speech carefully and loyally follows exactly according to the details of the concept, the speech comes first, and it's not a representation of that which is true in the higher world, then you've transformed, then the river flows and it doesn't come from its source. It's not that hidden wellspring that it should be. Then the mouth has been put in front of the eye. There's more depth here that needs explaining. I mean, without too much detail, a lot of what we're saying this evening, you might say, fits the sin of lies. Why Lashon Hara? After all, if we're saying that the mouth speaks and it's not a reflection of that which is the inner depth, isn't that telling lies? But see, Lashon Hara has a special depth. When you say that which is negative and true, there's a very subtle connection. Because when you tell a lie, you're not really speaking. A lie is a pretense at speaking. The definition of speech is taking that which is in the higher world and bringing it into the world of manifestation. That's what speech is. When you tell a lie, you're not speaking. You're pretending to speak. Something's coming out from the lips, but it's not a representation of that which is inward. You, on the contrary, you're betraying that which is inward. You say one thing, but it's not what you mean. That's a lie. You say one thing that purports to be the truth, and it's not the truth. It's not coming from that source. That's a lie. Lashon Hara is when what you say is negative and true. That is real speech, and it's being misused. That's a much deeper betrayal. That's a betrayal of speech itself. That's why we say, guard my lips from speaking. Yeah, we say, Nitzol l'shoni merah. Guard my tongue from speaking evil. Usfasai midabar mema. And my lips from speaking falsehood. The tongue, we ask to be guarded from Lashon Hara. The tongue is a deeper organ. Yeah, deeper, much closer to the source. That needs to be guarded from Lashon Hara. The lips, which are an outer organ, we ask to be protected from evil. Evil's from lies. Because lying speech is from the lips and out. There's no deeper source. But Lashon Hara is from a deeper source. It is true. It is speech and being used wrongly. This is the problem. And therefore, this peculiar source, we learn, let's try and sum it up. We learn the prohibition of Lashon Hara. We learn it not from a classic example of somebody who said something behind someone's back that was negative and true. We learn it from Miriam, who spoke about that which was above her, and we connect that to the Meraglim, who spoke about that which was beneath them. Miriam connects to the high world of Moshe, and she doesn't connect fully, and the Meraglim, bringing it down to the land itself, they perceive the land wrongly. These are the two polarities. These are the two poles. She doesn't fully ascend into that world of consciousness without any question of fault and blame. Instantaneously, her body is affected. And that oneg, that ecstasy of being connected to that higher world, is transformed into the leprous, you know, that outer revelation of problem. the Meraglim, as it were, what we learn there from Miriam, is that the Oneg becomes Nega. And what we learn from the Meraglim is putting the mouth in front of the eyes, Ikdimu Pe La'ayin, the reversal of those letters in the sequence, is they go into the land and they don't see accurately. The eyes don't see the way it is. Or rather, they see it, but the mouth distorts it. The speech comes out in a way that isn't an accurate reflection. It's a use of speech which is really true, but it's a misperception of the way things are, and it's a transmission of that misperception, and then the eyes begin to cry. Maral says that when the eyes cry, that is a dissolution of vision. You know, it's an amazing thing. That night is a night of crying. You know what bechi means? You know what crying means? Crying means, you know what crying means? Bechi in Hebrew, that word, to cry, boche. The same word in Hebrew means where the road is lost. Navoch in Hebrew means you can't find the way. Mevucha means amaze, can't find the way. Crying is the bodily representation of a road that has no... This road is not going from the original source to the final destination. This road has become... That's what Bechi means. And you know how it's manifest? By the eyes watering and the voice becoming inchoate, inarticulate. Because the eyes can't see anymore and the mouth can't speak. When the eyes and the mouth, the connection, have gone wrong here, then both become inactivated. The eyes water, the Maharal says, is the medium of dissolution, where things become dissolved and the shape is ground. The word dim'a in Hebrew, which means a tear, means where the thing becomes mixed. The same word dema in Hebrew means the thing is mixed, not clear anymore. That's what a tear is. The vision becomes... And when the eyes cry and the vision is blurred, you can't see where you're going anymore, the road is not clear, then of course the mouth can't speak anything. So the voice becomes inarticulate. So that's a night of crying where this gets confused and the eye and the mouth are confused, they get the wrong... It's a night of crying forever, that ninth of Av, which marks that. It's no accident that the word Eicha, which is lamentations, the Megillah of Lamentations, the same word is Ayeka, where are you? You're lost, where are you, Ayeka? When man sinned for the first time, and he got this original problem wrongly, when the serpent's voice confused the issue, but Tereshi, she saw it wrong, that's where this problem began. So after the sin, when he was hiding under the trees, and Hashem arrives in the garden, L'ruach Hayoim, and he says to him, Ayeka, where are you? Where are you? Ultimate expression of confusion. God himself saying, where are you? Because man has become confused and he's distorted, his path is lost. And Hashem, Tzilcha al-Yadiminecha, Hashem is your shadow. So when you can't find the way, the ultimate torture is not only that you lost, but the voice that he speaks to appears to be lost as well. Because he's hiding under the trees, not knowing where he is in the world. And Hashem appears and says, where are you? I can't see you, Ayeka. And when he crawls out, Hashem says, Hamina Eitz, did you eat from the tree? Did you? I don't know. And that word, Ayeka, where are you? Which means you're lost on the road. That's Eicha. That's the night of crying where you can't see the road and you can't even speak about it. What's the bottom line here? If you need a message, you know, a practical message to take home, I think we have to work on this. We live in a world where the words are primary. The words spill out and they vomit it out and spewed out and they don't come from a source. Or they come from a source that is so low that it's words themselves. When your inner life is a conversation, you're in big trouble. When you don't know things as they are, you know things only the way you've convinced yourselves by making a speech to yourself. And most people's thinking is reduced to that level. Your thoughts are actually what you sort of tell yourself, and then you run around and hear out sounds and you answer back. And the truth is, most of us don't even listen to what we're saying before we already think of the answer that proves that it was wrong in the first place. So your whole world of thoughts is the inner dialogue. So you never have a chance to actually know anything. Because it's always being brought down to how you're going to say it and express it and what you're going to say when they catch you, basically. But that's tears. That's tears and inarticulacy from the beginning. The first thing is silence. It's a silence where there's no attempt to put it into words because of the attempt to live in a world where the things can't be expressed. That's the process of Torah. Process of Torah means ascending into a world where things are known. Not into a world where things are expressed, a world in which things cannot be expressed. And then there's the judicious decision of what elements can be and what should be and what shouldn't be. And the listener, who's the sensitive type of listener, who will be able to appreciate and who will be able to know, and that's a relationship. It all begins from there. But if you live in a world which is the world of the so-called media, the world of spewed out meaningless, the world where the river begins with no source, where any words are okay, it doesn't matter where they come from. They're not the process. And therefore, in a very noisy world, in a world where any sense, any common sense, let alone deep spirituality, is drowned out by the falsehood and the nonsense and the emptiness and the unsophisticated nonsense or the sophisticated propaganda, the first thing is a world of a few minutes of silence, just a simple minute of meditation to get in touch with what that which really is. But I'm talking about you and me, not the world out there. The world out there is, that may come right one day, but if we do, we have to come right. We have to learn Torah on that level. We have to learn, we have to enter spirituality like that, to enter the world of spirituality and break it down, bring it down to the words that are finite and limited, and that which you can say and that which you can argue about. That's not Torah, and that's not the beginning of a relationship, not between a Rebbe and a Talmud, and not between husband and wife, not between friends. And that is the message. The root here of Lashon Hara is not the specific example of your saying something negative about somebody else behind his back. That's its application. But the root here is Hikdimu Peh La'ayin, and it's putting the mouth in front of the eye. It's changing that process of Eden, which is that world of ecstasy, the world of spirituality, the world of genuine spirit, when the ecstasy is nothing other than understanding itself. Can you imagine what a world like ours will experience when the final world is revealed, where all there is understanding? There is no body. There is no physicality. The whole ecstasy of that world is that which is genuinely understood beyond words. And the whole investment of lifetimes have been placed in that mode of just speaking and of the body expressing itself. That won't be an ecstasy. That'll be a torture. The trick is to develop an inner world where the ecstasy is in the understanding itself. You see people of spiritual greatness. You see they live in their own world. They have that world. They're never alone. They're never bored. They carry with them that world of depth. You can see it. Their life would be as richly aware if they were living on a desert island as living in a world where they're bothered by people like you and me. And that's the message. That's the message of the parshas. It's not to make the mistake that begins in the supernal root of a Miriam speaking words at her incredible level where she at a prophetic level is out of touch with the higher prophecy. That already is where it begins. And then expressing itself and extending itself to the Meraglim who come into the land and they don't see accurately, they don't maintain the silence that allows them to see accurately. That is the issue. Kol yamai gadalti ben hachachamim. All my days I was raised among the disciples. V'loy matzasi laguf tov mishtik. I never found anything better than silence. Okay.